Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge has temporarily blocked President Trump's new asylum ban. We'll discuss the reasoning for the move and how the case may ultimately play out.
First, there are a lot of pieces of history missing from lesson plans and history textbooks. And while the history of the women's movement is taught in classrooms with names like Susan B. Anthony or Harriet Tubman, the author of a new book says there's an important element that's been overlooked.
She says what drove many women to participate in political and social movements is something we don't like to talk about very much and isn't often well received. That's female anger.
Rebecca Traister is a journalist currently writing for New York Magazine and The Cut. Her new book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So in politics, the media, even in work and home settings, it seems like men can be angry and often get their way or at least make an impact, but an angry woman isn't taken as seriously. What are the ways that male and female anger are described or perceived?
Well, in part because men, and especially white men and powerful white men, are presumed to be rational beings. Their anger can be seen as bolstering their reasoning, a sign of their passion or their strength or their leadership qualities, their willingness to raise their voice and be assertive. But of course, when women get angry, they're often heard as hysterical, as irrational, over-emotional, unattractive. They're told that their anger will get them taken less seriously. Women of color, especially black women, are told that their anger makes them seem threatening. There are all kinds of ways in which if women who are presumed to be irrational and emotional from the start get angry, it only underlines their extra irrationality. And so their anger isn't taken seriously. And part of my argument in Good and Mad is that it certainly should be, especially in political contexts, because their anger has often been politically consequential.
Can you give us an example maybe of how an episode of a man being angry and expressing himself very forcefully, either currently or historically, and then a woman doing basically the same thing, how they're interpreted and portrayed differently?
Sure. We have been taught to fetishize certain instances of men's anger at what they perceive to be inequality. Think about how we think about our founding. The anger of the colonists at being taxed without representation in British government, this is our founding narrative. It's what led to revolution. And the anger, give me liberty or give me death, throwing tea into a harbor, this was political anger at injustice and a lack of representative democracy, and out of that was born a new nation. But of course, that new nation reinscribed the founders who were so mad at not being represented within the government that was policing them and taxing them and governing over them, then created a new country and a government that was built around the enslavement of a population of African Americans and the lack of enfranchisement of women, the unpaid labor of enslaved people and women. And when that oppressed those oppressed people voiced their anger, it wasn't regarded with the same kind of, oh, this is a revolution. In fact, it was regarded as a disruption. And you can look at the history of the suffrage movement, the abolition movement, which took, those movements took decades. The fight for full enfranchisement has taken centuries because the anger of other people, of women, for example, arguing for the vote, those, they were written off as unnatural, as angry Amazons, as hysterical, as bad mothers who were in their pursuit of getting the vote were leaving babies with their incapable dads. So we can see the way that one kind of insurgent political anger at inequality is admired in this country, and that's our patriotism and our looking toward the founding fathers. But other kinds of insurgencies, whether they have taken the form of civil rights movements or the gay rights movement or abolition or suffrage or labor movements, all of which, by the way, have angry women at their start, they're written off as movements that are, especially while they're going on, are disruptive to the power structure, are problematic, are changing the way things are, and they're not usually popular with the public.
And you talk, Rebecca, about the things that are reported in history, the women whose contributions are recognized, that those stories are very much sanitized. And what's missing is the anger in women like Susan B. Anthony, like Rosa Parks. What did their anger look like?
Well, Rosa Parks is a great example because she is an example of a woman who we're taught in our early years was catalytic and formative to the civil rights movement and refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus in Alabama in 1955. But we're taught about her as exhausted and stoic and demure and that she was a seamstress. But in fact, Rosa Parks was a lifelong fighter against racial injustice. She was furious and described herself as angry from the time she was a child at the racism that determined the scope of her opportunities as a black woman in the South, in the United States, in the Jim Crow South. She worked as an investigator for the NAACP, investigating the gang rapes of black women by white men and false claims of sexual assault made by white women against black men. She dedicated her life to political activism, and that activism was stemmed from her anger at inequality and at racist violence. And her decision to sit on that seat and not give it up in 1955 wasn't just because she was exhausted, although I have no doubt that she was, in fact, tired and exhausted. She was angry, and she wanted to engage in civil disobedience in a politicized act. She wanted this to be catalytic to something like the bus boycott, which it wound up being. But we're never told that part of her story. We're never asked to understand Rosa Parks as intentional and political in her actions. It's like the anger is drained from her, and the only way that we can celebrate her is as stoic and tired and nonviolent.
So, Rebecca, do you think that there's been a conscious effort to sanitize, to take that passion out of these acts and remove that element of anger from the telling of these stories?
I do think so, because we're so trained to view women's anger as ugly or unpleasant. We don't want to look straight at it. There's another great example, actually, from the period of the founding. There's one line that we're always taught that was kind of the feminist line during the revolutionary period, and it's from Abigail Adams, who is married to John Adams, who would go on to be president and was one of the founding fathers. And I was always taught that the great line was, "Remember the ladies, John," right? This is what she writes him in a letter in the 1770s. That's the line we learn, "Remember the ladies," which is a pretty mild request, you know, just remember that there are women. The funny thing is, in that same letter, she's far angrier than that line would suggest. In that same letter, she writes that all men would be tyrants if they could. That is a pretty furious statement, suggesting that all men, if given free rein, would be tyrants. That's the language of revolution and tyrannical rule by the king. She then promises in that same letter that if the founders do not include women in their vision for the new nation, she says, "We promise to foment a rebellion." So she is promising revolution along the same lines that her husband is just engaged in. And yet that's stripped from what is passed along to us in the popular narrative, and the way that I was taught this in elementary school, and I think the way that most documentaries, on PBS tell us that all she really asked was, you know, to remember the ladies, when in fact she was promising something far more disruptive politically.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister right now. Her new book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. So that's really interesting what you were just saying, Rebecca, because it seems like if women's anger wasn't seen as a threat, then there wouldn't be a reason to downplay or to dismiss it. So why do you think women's anger is seen as such a threat by men, others in power, and powerful institutions?
Well, I think it is a threat. We know back from that from our founding that anger at inequality, anger at injustice can lead to massive political rupture, can lead to real revolution. That's how this country was born. And I think that given that when it was built around all kinds of inequalities that actually mirrored the very inequalities that the colonists were fighting against when they went to war with England. The lack of representation. You had African Americans and women who were not civically engaged, were not civically permitted to participate, to vote, to be enfranchised. And I think there was always the knowledge that if they revolted in the way that the colonists had revolted against England, that real disruption would be possible. And in fact, we have seen that. That is the story of many of the social movements. That is eventually the abolition movement that led to the emancipation of enslaved people. The 14th and 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment that enfranchised some women, the Voting Rights Act, which 45 years after that in 1965, fully enfranchised African Americans. There have been versions of revolutions that have expanded opportunities for more people. And again, each and every one of those movements was driven at the beginning in part by women who were furious. The labor movement resulted in higher wages, in workplace safety regulations, limits to some degree on what corporations could ask of their workers, protections for workers. There is revolutionary change possible, but it's going to be anger at inequality that motivates that. And so there's an incentive to keep people who are on the margins, who are in some way subjugated or oppressed, from voicing their anger, because that anger can lead to the kind of connection and coalition building and the organizing that actually does alter and challenge a power structure and how it works.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister. She's a journalist and author, and her newest book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you see a difference in how women's and men's anger are treated? If you're a woman, have there been times in your life where you feel like you made yourself more polite in order to not make a stir? Or do you think you don't have permission to be angry? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with Rebecca Traister. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, we'd especially like to hear from you right now. Do you feel comfortable expressing your anger as a woman? And do you think anger helps or hurts political causes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Rebecca, before we took that short break, you were talking about how different marginalized people have been divided and how that has made it easier to prevent coalitions that might form and threaten power structures as they are. And in your book, you also talk about how women have been divided and that different women's anger is treated differently. Talk more about that. How is it different for marginalized women versus, say, straight white women with economic means?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are incredible differences, and one of the hardest parts about progressive organizing, not just within a women's movement in all its iterations, but within all kinds of left movements, is that, of course, many of the power hierarchies, biases, and inequalities are repeated within progressive coalitions. And so, yes, racism in particular and white supremacy is something that has existed within the women's movement, in which so often it's women of color and often black women who have done the groundbreaking thinking, legal work, organizing, sort of pavement pounding, door knocking to be, have done so much of the work of progressive organizing, and very often white women who, because of their proximal power to white men, when they have come into a women's movement, have often sort of become the loudest voices, have become the public faces, have shifted some of the priorities of organizing around the needs of white women. And that's one of the very difficult but necessary conversations that I think is happening now as a women's movement reforms in these years. And there have been extremely angry voices amongst women who are furious about inequality between them. And inequality that is perpetuated even in progressive movements. And that's, I believe that anger, the voicing of it and the listening to it and trying to address what the anger is pointing us toward is one of the crucial steps in moving forward and having stronger and more inclusive progressive movements.
Let's go to the phones, and Marty is on the line in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, everybody. Rebecca, I have your book sitting on the table in the house there, so I'm anxiously awaiting opening it up. I heard about it the evening It must have been a month ago when my book club was getting together, and it's a group of 13 very fabulous women. And boy, talk about a spirited discussion. We had a great time just talking about rage, women's rage. I think women need to get over the reaction to our anger. I'm tired of stepping it back just because I'm afraid, and it's usually of offending a man or making a man. I don't know what I'm going to make a man, but again, this we were talking about your book around the time the Kavanaugh hearings were sort of winding up, or he had just been, I guess, put on the Supreme Court. Can you please talk about any aspect of those hearings that relate to what your book is about? Thank you so very much.
Thanks for that call, Marty. Rebecca?
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate that. And yes, the Kavanaugh, my book was published just 5 days after Christine Blasey Ford gave her testimony and then Brett Kavanaugh gave his. And that was another instance. I almost answered an earlier question about instances where men's anger is heard differently from women's. We could, on that one day, we had two examples of Christine Blasey Ford, who we know instinctively could not have raised her voice in anger as she was telling her story to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Had she raised her voice in anger, despite the fact that she had plenty of things she might well have been justifiably angry about, had she raised her voice, she would have been heard as over-emotional, unreliable as a narrator. She was too emotional to remember the details. It's unthinkable that she could have yelled back or turned the questions back on the questioners the way that Brett Kavanaugh was able to do later in the afternoon. You remember he raised his voice, he wept, he cried, he yelled, he snapped at Senator Amy Klobuchar and said, "Did you black out?" It was an astounding display of anger. And of course, he was backed up by Senator Lindsey Graham, who also had an angry explosion on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh. And I think that the contrast between, it wasn't, on the one hand, it was, yes, Christine Blasey Ford sort of was not permitted to use anger to express herself, and Brett Kavanaugh was. But more than that, had Christine Blasey Ford used anger, it would have undermined her case. It would have confirmed that she was just emotional, that her voice was not a reliable one. But Brett Kavanaugh, who by dint of his gender, his race, and his power within that judiciary chamber, is presumed to be a reasonable thinker. He is offered, there's a presumption that he's rational from the beginning. When he uses anger, he can use it, he's not only allowed to use it, he can wield it as a weapon on his own behalf to underscore how passionately he feels about something, how righteous his fury and his commitments are. And he was able to make his case, at least with the Senate Judiciary, those other powerful people who were fundamentally deciding whether or not to believe him or Dr. Blasey Ford. Brett Kavanaugh was permitted to use anger, and Lindsey Graham was permitted to use anger to strengthen their cases, whereas we know that had Christine Blasey Ford used it, it would have weakened her case. But then the next day, I have to add one more thing. There was another example of women's anger. The two women, Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher, who confronted Jeff Flake in the elevator, and in part because they were not aiming to convince powerful people on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Yes, they were talking to one of them, Jeff Flake. But the reason that their anger, when they confronted him on the elevator and said, "Listen to our stories, you're not believing us, you're not hearing us," and their voices shook and they pointed their fingers, and it was so powerful a clip that it went viral. And I think in part that was because it wasn't to impress the powerful people. It was giving voice to those who felt they didn't have any power, millions of women and men around the country who were so angry and feeling it. And those two women in the elevator gave it voice and channeled that anger of so many people around the country. And that was a very powerful use of anger and women's anger.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister about her new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Let's try to take one more call. Kendra in Milwaukee. Hi, Kendra.
Hi there. I am pretty much on the same topic as she was talking about, in that when women are angry, we are thought to be out of control. You know, if our hormones that have taken over, we're not in control, so therefore our arguments can't be considered rational or carry any weight, you know. Just think about being in high school and somebody saying, "What's wrong? Are you on the rag?"
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Kendra. And Rebecca, it sounds like that resonates with you.
It does resonate, and I especially like the fact that the first way that Kendra put it was that women are presumed to be out of control. We have to think about that notion of control and how it relates to power and who gets to wield power. And that notion, we could even the way that people reacted after the Kavanaugh hearings when Donald Trump and many of the Republicans tried to cast the female protesters as a mob. Oh, this is a mob that had come after Brett Kavanaugh. There's a way, or after the hashtag MeToo movement of last fall, the way that that was depicted as a witch hunt, something that was out of control, out of order, and chaotic and disruptive. And that's part of the point and the power of women's anger, is that it breaks control, which is, again, its point, because control is how power is wielded, how it is abused, and how people are cut off from it. And so when women are angry, at least from a progressive perspective, what they're doing is challenging and complicating the power of people who traditionally have had a lot of authority to maintain that authority without challenge.
And Rebecca, as we start to wrap up, you know, there were the women's marches, as you said, the Me Too movement, with the midterms, more women than ever being elected to governmental positions. It seems like there are examples of women in a powerful position, you know, speaking truth to power in many of these situations. For women who have been steeped for many, many years in this sense of containing their anger, of being afraid to show their anger, is there a way to build a healthy relationship with justified anger?
I think it begins, the most important part is listening to the anger of those around you. So there are going to be all kinds of different levels of comfort with expressing your anger. And of course, there are real costs to it. This book is not telling women out there to just go rage on, because the truth is that we still get punished and censured if we voice our rage and, you know, get reputations for being difficult or maybe don't get promotions. Women of color are at risk if they get angry. They're at risk of arrest, of injury, of somebody calling the police on them. There are real costs to expressing anger, and I don't want to pretend that those don't exist and just say, go on, everybody, you know, be mad in public. The thing I can encourage is that we start to tune our ears to listen to the anger around us and think about the ways we've been trained to discount it and try to counterbalance that by trying to listen to it, take it seriously. And if we share the anger that we're hearing expressed, communicate with the people who are expressing it and try to find some cooperation and some coalition with them. We have to change how anger is received, and we can do that by changing the ways in which we ourselves listen to it and take it seriously.
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Traister is a journalist currently writing for New York Magazine and The Cut. She has a new book out. It's called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
I'm J. Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time.